You are listening to a sermon by Thomas Bergen, recorded on Sunday, November 23, 2014, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So like Veronica said, today I'm preaching my third sermon in the sermon series that I've entitled Cultural Liturgies. Liturgies of the Mall, the Stadium, and today the last one on the University. Most of you are here for the other two, or at least many of you were, but just in case you weren't, or in case you've forgotten, I'm going to begin with a brief recap. Back in September, I invited you all to imagine that you were Martians. You were sent to planet Earth from an intergalactic space station to test the hypothesis of human religiosity. You collected data from a mall and concluded that humanity expressed its religious identity in and through the liturgies there. These liturgies included hearing advertisements which summoned worship, appreciating architecture which resembled typical features of sacred space, observing mall mannequins which embodied the mall's religious view of the good life, participating in communities of shoppers organized around brand loyalties, being ushered into the mall's mysteries of production and disposal, transubstantiating store products into personal possessions through a sacrificial exchange, and investing in the mall's Great Commission. That was a long sentence. Then last month, I preached a sermon on sports and spirituality. My interest in this topic was inspired by my Brazilian friend's comment that soccer in Brazil is a national religion. I explored how professional sports, like religion, elicit ecstatic levels of devotional intensity that call for bodily and financial sacrifice. I explored how sports, especially spectator sports, like religion, create powerful social bonds among fans, how liturgies of the stadium reenact founding national myths through elaborate pregame pageantries, and how competitive sports suspend the normal rules of morality for the ultimate goal of winning. So these are all attributes of religion that the mall and the stadium both meet. Throughout this series, I've challenged the secular cultural assumption that human beings in the 21st century are not as religious as they once were. Ever since the Enlightenment, we in the West have accepted as axiomatic the separation of mind from heart, of facts from values, and of secularism from religion. I believe these barriers are breaking down. My goal in these sermons has been to advance a more integrated understanding of worship, an understanding of worship that is something that we all do and that we do with all of ourselves. Heart, mind, soul, body, as Jesus said. The separation between the heart and mind and between the religious and the irreligious is thin indeed. We all worship, and we all worship with all of ourselves. As David Foster Wallace put it in the quote, which I have opened this sermon series with, and I've repeated every time, there is no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. We all worship. The only thing we get to decide is what we will worship. If I had to choose one verse which would sum up the essence of this series, it would be 1 John 5:21, the verse we read earlier. And it's interesting how it's the last word of his epistle. He doesn't expand on it, he just throws it out there as if it's going to just be ringing in our minds. And that word is, guard yourselves against idols. The fact that we need to guard ourselves against idolatry implies that idolatry is an ever-present danger. Today we are inundated by the mantra that our cultural institutions and practices are religiously neutral. Living in a secular culture that lives in denial of religion makes idolatry harder to detect. However, while traditional religions have been dwindling in number and influence, modern forms of worship have been surfacing under new guises and disguises. As Wallace goes on to say in that same quote, "The insidious thing about modern forms of worship is that they are often unconscious. They're the kind of worship you gradually slip into day after day until they become your default settings. According to Wallace, what you consciously believe or don't believe isn't necessarily indicative of what you in fact worship. He applies this truth to atheists who don't think they are worshiping anything, but I'm applying it to Christians who may be worshiping idols without knowing it. Jeremiah 17:9 states that our heart is deceitful above all else. Who can know it? This verse raises an important set of questions. If our hearts are so deceitful, how can we be sure about what our hearts are worshiping? And if our hearts have a mind of their own, so to speak, how can we help our hearts to live in accordance with our consciously held beliefs? And finally, what might help to keep our hearts stoked, to feel what we know we ought to feel? Liturgies. The simplest definition of a liturgy is a worship aid. Liturgies are practices that help us worship. Liturgies do not simply express our hearts, they shape our hearts. Liturgies do not simply manifest our consciously held beliefs, they confirm those beliefs as true and enduringly valid. Through singing, praying, confessing, serving, giving, witnessing, being baptized, partaking of the Lord's Supper, all of these practices, they're bodily. And they're the bodily Christian practices of the liturgy that shape us into worshipers, into Christian worshipers. They train our hearts to love and worship God. They direct our hearts and desires towards God's kingdom. And they do this by putting our bodies through a regimen of repeated and symbolic actions. The liturgies of the mall and the stadium operate in the same way. They work on our hearts from our bodies up to shape us into idol worshippers. Therefore, we must be on guard against idolatry by paying attention to the formative role of our bodily practices and liturgies. So enough of the recap. Let us turn our attention now to today's topic, which is the university and its liturgies. My sermon will have four main parts. First, I will challenge the notion of the university as a secular institution. I will do this by showing how the university fits the liturgical definition of religion I've just outlined. Second, I will consider how the liturgies of the university shape students. Third, I will survey some of the problems that the university is running into because it denies its religiosity. And finally, I will wrap up with a reflection on the liturgies of the Metal Simon Center. Let us start by considering my claim that the university is not a secular institution, but a religious one. Maybe you've agreed with me so far in this series that the mall and the stadium are religious, but you're skeptical about the university. Surely if there is one place in our secular society that is truly secular, it is the university. I agree. The university is the best candidate for a truly secular institution. Consider the University of Pittsburgh, which has a reputation for being very secular. Unlike other prominent American universities, it has no religious past. If any university can discredit my hypothesis of human beings as invariable worshippers, it is the University of Pittsburgh. Let us suppose, then, that we were able to visit the university and collect some data to test my hypothesis. What would we find? Did anybody guess a cathedral? You're right, a cathedral. It's towering above this university. It stands as one of the most stunning pieces of academic architecture in the United States, and it's called the Cathedral to Learning. The cathedral is intentionally Gothic, invoking the architectural grammar of medieval cathedrals. But here, the aspiring architecture is no longer striving to point to the creator, but to enlightened human reason. To add to the irony, the engraving on the cornerstone references the Christmas story. Quote, "Like the magi of ancestral traditions and the shepherds of candid simplicity, we offer our precious and genuine gifts to truth that shines forever and enlightens all people." Here in the Cathedral of Learning, students will be religious seekers. But unlike the shepherds and magi who came seeking to worship a divine savior and king, these students will worship an immanent truth of human reason. I realize I'm 1 week early for references to the Christmas story, But, hey, you can blame the University of Pittsburgh. Don't be fooled by the lack of a plaque on other universities, and don't miss the meaning of one when you find it. The Cathedral of Learning illustrates what is taking place in university learning spaces more generally. Its reference to the Christmas story is not simply a cute historical reference. It is a sign that we as human beings cannot help but reference religion. The secular university believes that once upon a time, during the dark medieval ages, the university was oppressed by religious dogma. Long lay the world in ignorance and error pining, till the light of the Enlightenment appeared. Through a heroic journey, wise men and women followed that light, prevailing against the dark forces of religious censorship, until they discovered the truth. And so at last the university emerged as a dispassionate dispenser of truth, an enlightened purveyor of objective knowledge. It is an inspiring story, but it misses two important details. First, that the university was for centuries founded and animated by a religious vision. And second, that knowledge cannot be objective. There is no knowledge without knowers, no science without scientists, and no impersonal notions of what is rational and true available to persons. I want to expand on this a little bit. All knowledge is conditioned by our rootedness as people in places and practices. All knowledge is religious because all knowers are religious. Try as it might, the university cannot be truly secular. The conditions of knowledge forbid it. Instead, the conditions of knowledge force the university to consider how its bodily liturgies and hermeneutical communities shape its notions of truth. Which raises the question, what are the bodily liturgies? What are the hermeneutical communities of the university? That question leads us into the second part of my sermon, in which I will discuss the liturgies of the university and how they shape students. To locate the liturgies of the university, it is important to recognize that the university that is inhabited by professors, many of you have this experience, you'll know that it is very different from the university inhabited by students. Scholars who think about the university tend to identify its nerve center as the sites of teaching and research, classrooms and lecture halls, labs and libraries. But for students, the university is much bigger. It includes dorm rooms, dining halls, frat houses, and sports stadiums. The university is indeed a place of mind, as the UBC slogan says, but it is a place of much more activity than simply mental activity. I find it interesting that universities' marketing to parents emphasize that the university is a place of higher learning in which big ideas and marketable skills will be implanted into eager young minds. By contrast, those who sell the university to potential students emphasize that the university is an experience, a rite of passage, a social adventure, both a postponement of and a rehearsal for the proverbial real world. Consider, for instance, the university's liturgy of initiation. In Canada, it's known as Frosh Week. In the States, Freshers Week. During this intensive week of learning, older students initiate new students into the nooks and crannies of the university's life. These older students communicate what is valued in university life: carefree social interaction, facilitated by alcohol, of course, cult-like devotion to the sports team, and the solidification of social networks that will be instrumental for future gain. As seniors give tips to freshmen about how to maintain the partying lifestyle of Freshers' Week, students learn that studying is something that they will have to fit into what otherwise really matters at university. In traditional rites of passage ceremonies, participants were separated from their communities just before undergoing that rite, which would transform them from novitiates into full-standing members. It's what we call the rite of passage. In the same way, Freshers' Week pulls students out of the workaday world of summer jobs and they ready them to participate in the campus life. In the retreat-like setting of Freshers' Week, students are immersed in social antics and activities. Some will consider them unwelcome. However, their resistance will be largely futile, the liturgical forces of stigmatization against those who do not participate will be as powerful as the liturgical forces of welcome for those who do. After this intensive, full-bodied liturgy of initiation, Freshers' Week is followed by the liturgies of Rush Week. If you haven't heard of Rush Week, it's because you never attended an American university. During Rush Week, students compete to be recruited for fraternities and sororities, which will confer status and connections upon accepted members. Because having relatives in a fraternity or a sorority is often the key for being accepted, these groups tend to incubate class distinctions and class sensibilities. Perhaps most significantly for our liturgical analysis, participation in these groups encourage members to view education and relationships as tools, means to one's future ends. Before students have written their first midterm, they have already established themselves in hermeneutical communities that will condition their classroom learning. Consider some other liturgies of student life: coming-of-age drinking parties, strange group initiation rites and pranks in dorms, casual hookup sex, all-nighters before exams and project deadlines. And you get a good picture of a binging lifestyle governed by frenetic rhythms of expenditure and exhaustion. This lack of Sabbath, too, turns out to be an excellent preparation for the real world, the real world of corporate ladder climbing and white-collar overtime that is needed to be successful. In short, while the official story of the university is that it's what students learn in the classroom that will prepare them to be productive members of society, it is actually the liturgies outside the classroom that will likely constitute the most formative aspect of university education. While the official liturgies of the university, such as commencement and convocation, will have some impact on students, the unofficial liturgies are likely more formative. The formative power of the university's liturgies is explored in Tom Wolfe's 2004 novel entitled I Am Charlotte Simmons. In this novel, the protagonist is a gifted student who finds her identity in her grades. She comes to university as the valedictorian from a small town high school with great ambitions for cultivating her mind. What Charlotte quickly realizes is that the university is a place of bodies. Quote, humid fraternity houses and dorms that reek with vomit, alcohol, and the body odors of the drunken male animal, unquote. Later, Charlotte is sitting in an evolutionary psychology class. Her professor explains that not only emotions, but also purpose and intention are merely physical matters. Charlotte realizes that her mental aspirations are no different than the bodily desires of the, quote, drunken male animal. Her sense of academic ambition and moral fortitude dissolves. Her identity-preserving mantra, I am Charlotte Simmons, is silenced. Her tragic conversion complete. Although the novel exaggerates certain aspects of university life, the novel does an amazing job of highlighting the power of the liturgies of the university. New York Times columnist David Brooks had this to say about I Am Charlotte. Tom Wolfe's novel locates one of the paradoxes of our age. Highly educated young people are tutored and taught in all aspects of their lives except the most important, character building. When it comes to this, most universities leave them alone. As a result, students find themselves in a world of unprecedented ambiguity, where it's not clear if you're going out with the person you're having sex with, and where it's not clear if anything is true. Unquote. But is David Brooks right? Do universities leave students alone in the vital character-building task of education? Or do they provide the liturgies that often destroy character? I believe it is the latter. So, let's move on now to the third part of my sermon. In the first part, I challenged the university's claim to be secular. In the second part, I discussed how the liturgies of the university shape the religious orientation of students at the university. And now it's time to consider some of the problems the university is running into because of its commitment to secularism. When you deny the religious nature of human beings, you are living in denial of one of the most fundamental aspects of human reality. That's going to cause some problems. For example, how will you justify a distinction between the value of human life and other life forms? How will you judge between moral and religious differences when you are committed to ignoring difference and insinuating equivalency? How will you teach professional programs which all relate to serving human beings and their social and political goals? Let me expand on this last problem, the particular problem of teaching professional programs. In the early days of the modern university, its dominant quest was to understand physical reality through physical sciences. It was easier then for the university to consider itself secular because it is harder to see how religion is relevant to that quest. However, professional programs like medicine, law, business, education, and agriculture are all devoted not just to understanding physical reality, but to applying our understanding of physical reality to human realities. In professional programs, questions about how we can create the optimal conditions for human beings are at the center of attention. Increasingly, the burden of proof will fall onto secularists to show how they can answer these questions without religious language. The university's commitment to secularism causes another significant problem: its inability to define the purpose of education. According to T.S. Eliot, quote, "We can have no clear or useful idea of what education is unless we have some notion of what education is for." To define education, we are forced to define man. Every definition of the purpose of education therefore implies some concealed philosophy or theology. Unquote. Religious language is the language of purpose. And religious language is not necessary to give students knowledge and skills, but it is definitely necessary to teach students what knowledge and skills should be used for. Fortunately for the university, avoiding the question of education's purpose hasn't magically made the question disappear. As the university abandons the question of education's purpose, the market pressures the university to adopt its own purposes. Without a strong vision or sense of purpose, the university will look more and more like the submissive handmaiden of market purposes. Increasingly, every faculty is asked to justify its existence to university administrations and students in terms of market usefulness. I feel bad for the university, especially for humanities faculties. But if the university is unable to make a clear statement of purpose for fear of sounding religious, the university should not be surprised if it takes on the amoral aspects of the market. It shouldn't be surprised if students act like consumers and treat teachers like their paid employees who are obligated to provide them the product of education. It shouldn't be surprised if students treat academic degrees as little more than hunting licenses to make a killing in the market. It shouldn't be surprised when higher education is considered a passport to privilege rather than a preparation for civic service and responsibility. It shouldn't be surprised when students graduate with competence but without character. However, Harvard Business School alumnus John Shedd was quite surprised when graduates from his prestigious alma mater showed an abnormally high propensity towards felonious behavior. He decided to offer the Harvard Business School $30 million to develop an ethics course which would correct some of these problems. And what was the point of this course? What was the course trying to convince students of? That crime doesn't pay. It's an ironic tale. Even when the university recognizes that it is morally bankrupt, it still tries to reduce moral declarations to the language of pragmatism. The university cannot say to a bunch of MBA students that stealing money and hiding it in a maze of stock transactions is morally wrong. It can only say that, pragmatically speaking, it is wrong, since you will probably get caught, and then it will cost you. So far, I've challenged the university's claim to be secular by pointing out the personal conditions of knowledge. I've just discussed those personal conditions, or liturgies, and now I've also pointed out some of the problems the university is running into because of its unsustainable commitment to secularism. I want to conclude today's sermon with a fourth part, considering the liturgies of the Menno Simon Center. I love the Menno Simon Center. I think what is happening here is quite special. I'm excited to work here because I think that many of the idolatrous liturgies of the university are being countered by the liturgies we practice here. Like the plaque on the Cathedral of Learning at the University of Pittsburgh, our identity and mission is plain to all who enter the center. An Anabaptist timeline reminds us of our identity. Pictures display our goal of living for the glory of God. The sign on our door reminds us that our mission is to be peacemakers. And of course, the chapel at the center of our building reminds the students that God is the center of our lives. Here at the Menno Simon Center, students admit that their view of truth is defined by their commitment to Jesus Christ, whom they believe is the truth. They acknowledge that their knowledge is conditioned by their rootedness in liturgical practices and hermeneutical community. They accept that education is always an education for a purpose. And so, here at the Menno Simon Center, we get busy rooting ourselves in liturgical practices that will form us to be more like Jesus as we inform ourselves about the world. We get busy creating a hermeneutical community that will help us to interpret the world in a Christian way. We get busy pursuing education for the purpose of serving God and His purposes in the world. Our liturgy of initiation is not Freshers' Week. It is the fall and winter retreats. During these intensive, full-bodied retreats, students are prepared for the challenge of living together through community-defining games, discussions, and interactions. Older students instruct younger students about the nooks and crannies of life at the center and about how to balance the value of doing well at school with other values. Carefree social interaction is facilitated not by alcohol, but by meals that we share together. By participating together in small groups and Bible studies here, they're invited to know others and let themselves be known by others on a deeper level. Participation does not confer status and connections so much as connection. By contributing an hour of cleaning every week, students learn to take personal responsibility for the community's well-being. By living in a community with clear rules and expectations, students realize that morality is never something that we exercise or decide upon individually. By eating together once a week for a common meal, students have a built-in midweek practice of Sabbath. The word university is a composite of two words, unity and diversity. By living together with students from all sorts of different programs of study, united by a common faith in Jesus Christ, residents here have a true experience of unity and diversity. At least in this sense, the liturgies of the Menno Simon Center are a better example of university liturgies. The university denies that it is a religious institution. It claims to be a place of mind. I chose Romans 12 as one of the texts this morning because it reminds us that the life of the mind is inseparable from the life of our bodies. Offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, and your mind will be renewed, says Paul. If you don't, you will inevitably conform yourself to the patterns of this world. Therefore, renew your mind by offering your bodies as sacrifices of worship. Prophesy, teach, encourage, show mercy, give, love, pray, hope, serve, practice hospitality, bless, honor, keep your fervor, hope, rejoice, mourn, associate, do right, and live at peace. These are all the liturgies from Romans 12 that we strive to practice here at Menno along with Christians everywhere. Throughout this series, I've tried to challenge the secular assumptions, especially the assumption of the separation of mind from heart and of the religious from the irreligious. Through my analysis of the liturgies of the mall, the stadium, and the university, I've tried to demonstrate that we all worship with all of ourselves. In conclusion, guard yourselves against idolatry and worship God. Guard yourselves against the idolatry of the mall, the idolatry of the stadium, and the idolatry of the university. And keep your eyes open for other kinds of cultural liturgies that might be out there as well. Amen.